offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. We welcome you to this week's episode of the Afternoon Satsang. This is Prem, and with me is Arvind, and we're joining you from our studios at Prashanti Nilayam, the Shri Satsang Media Center. And we are here to resume our discussion on the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. We are towards the end of the book, but I think nevertheless we will have a good couple of episodes before we are able to conclude this. And as always, very, very interesting themes and topics lined up today as we follow the book. Some things which are very practical, which are practical even for us today, and some things which are very important for deep contemplation. To give you a brief summary of what we covered last time, there isn't any direct reference to what we are going to discuss today with what we discussed last time. But a very important and critical question that Hislop asked is about how do you make choices in life when there is a pleasant option in front of you? Why is it that you have to look beyond that? And Swami gave a beautiful explanation about that, of how you make the purpose as the primary operator when you're making a choice. And it is not that you shouldn't choose something that is pleasurable, but as long as it is in line with the purpose that you've set for yourself, it is fine. And that is essentially what is referred to in Vedanta and Swami's discourses as Shreyas and Prayas. And Swami spoke about that. But what we're going to have as a discussion today is quite different and unique from that. But before we dwell into that, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem, and Sairam to all our listeners. As you put it, Prem, the topic this time will be different. But even as you were speaking about making choices, it just occurred to me that among the six questions that are usually asked in English, who, when, where, how, what, and why, these are the six questions that are asked. Out of these, the three important questions are how, what, and why. You know, in fact, the what actually decides what we are going to do, and the how decides how we are going to do it. There is constantly a kind of debate between the what and how, because people often wonder whether the means justify the ends or do the ends justify the means. The ends are what we are doing, whether if what we are doing is noble, if it is good, does it justify whatever we do to achieve it? There is one section of people who say that that is important, what we do. As long as what we do is good, how we do it doesn't matter. Then there's another section of people who say that how we do something is so important, because that determines the purity or the impurity of what is being done. Even if it's a noble end, but if you take wrongful means to achieve it, the ends itself gets maligned. I think Swami's answer, what we got in the last discussion, is so critical, because there is one question that's more important than both these, what and how, and that is the why. What Swami calls as the intent behind it, the bhavam. That's why Swami says that God is bhavapriya. He sees the feelings, not what you're doing or how you're doing it, but why you're doing it. So I think this why, this question why, is so important in all our decision making. If the why is right, then there are times when the ends justify the means. If the why is right, there are times when the means justify the ends. So the resolution of the debate between means and ends comes from the intent or the why of what we are doing. And therefore, that was a very, very important and good rule of the thumb. Because when we have to do something, when we are pondering about how to do it or whether we should do it or not, I think we should just examine our intent. If the intent is pure and selfless, it makes it very clear to select a black and white answer, a yes and no answer. So those are a few thoughts regarding what we had discussed last week.
Right, and we'll probably dive right away into what Hislop is asking here, because it's a very interesting question, though he wishes to call it something else, because this is how Hislop poses his question. He says, this question will sound silly to Swami, but it is serious to me. That is how he starts his discussion, and Swami says, what is it? And Hislop says, I write many letters to Swami about activities, problems and accomplishments in the American Sai organization. But often I think it is silly to describe problems and events, since I know from my own direct experience that Swami is omnipresent and knows all about the events. Swami's response to that is, there is much nonsense about Swami being omnipresent and omnipotent. People start to think that they need to do nothing, that Swami will do everything. Then they do not bother to do even their daily duty. So that is Swami's response, and very interesting response. There is much nonsense about Swami being omnipresent and omnipotent.
I can totally understand this, because, you know, if we take the example, the famous analogy of God being the scriptwriter and everybody being mere puppets or actors. When we take the case of an actor, there is the script and there is no choice for the actor other than deliver the script. But still, how the script is delivered, how the actor presents himself makes a lot of difference. Whether he is in the role, whether he is not in the role, whether he is being sincere to the role, all of those determine how well the drama or movie is going to be. If you take it a step further and say, no, we are not even actors, we are just puppets in the puppeteer's hands, then also it is important that the puppet's strings be tight. It should not be that they get cut off. The different parts of the puppet's body, they be in a good condition. So that duty, that responsibility lies with the puppet. It's not as if you give up everything. Because I think in the Bhagavad Gita also it is clearly said that action is inevitable. You have to act. Even when you think you're doing nothing, your stomach is digesting food, you're breathing, so many actions are going on. So action is inevitable. So I think we are only giving scope or vent to our tamasic nature or our laziness when we say that, no, God is in charge, I will not do anything. You know, when that is the case, why do I go and put food in my mouth when I'm hungry? Why do I go to the restroom when I get the call of nature? This was the kind of hypocrisy that Swami would often point out and puncture during some of the intimate conversations. When I remember on an occasion when Swami asked a student why he was not singing, the student felt it was justified because he had a bad throat a few days back, and Swami had told him to take rest. Now his throat had recovered, but he was awaiting Swami's permission, and that's what he told. He said, Swami, I am waiting for your permission. If you permit me, I will sing. Then Swami asked him, did you have food today? Yes. Swami meant to say that, did you take my permission before having food? So when it comes to your food, when it comes to, as I said, going to the restroom, whatever, you feel these actions, it's not as if I give up action and I give up those. No, those I will anyway continue to do. Then why this partial or selective neglect of certain actions? That's why Swami, I mean, if you take that sentence in isolation, it is misleading. When Swami says there is much nonsense about Swami being omnipresent and omnipotent. But when we understand the context, Swami is saying that yes, God is omnipresent, omnipotent, but as an actor, as a puppet, however you consider that, there are some things that you need to do, and there is no escaping that. You can't use God being omnipresent or omnipotent as a way of escapism from what you are expected to do.
Even as I was reading this section of the conversation, again, it reminds me that we did the mistake of saying that this is different from the portion that we discussed last time, because it is definitely connected. Because if you recall in the last answer that Swami gave about making choices, Swami used those three catchwords which Swami often speaks about: duty, devotion and discipline. Swami says those should be your guiding principle. Right? Because when Hislop is asking this question, I think there are two angles to it. He's talking about writing letters, which is going to be discussed later specifically. But Swami is also addressing the issue of some people who are trying to avoid what is their duty, taking recourse in this statement that everything is done by God. After all, Swami is the doer and Swami is the omnipotent one. Swami is addressing those two issues. Because oftentimes the problem is not in thinking that Swami is, anyway, Swami knows everything. The problem is in using that as an alibi to, you know, not do what you're supposed to do, what is expected of you. As you rightly gave the example of, you know, that singer. Sometimes we kind of divide our life into, you know, these are things where we need Swami's physical involvement, and these are things where, you know, Swami knows everything, and if nothing is happening, Swami is blessing it. I think we always do that to conveniently, you know, take recourse in the choice that we've already made. Mm. I think Swami is making a mention of that, and that's why, so in such forceful words, Swami is saying there's so much nonsense about being omnipotent and omnipresent, of Swami being omnipotent and omnipresent.
In particular, you know, when you mentioned about Shreyo and Preyo Marga, the Shreyo Marga is supposed to be, not supposed to be, is the right path,
right.
Is the good path, and the Preyo Marga is the pleasant path. I think this kind of attributing everything to Swami's omnipresence and omnipotence also occurs when it's time for us to take a tough call, when we have to take a decision, especially when we are faced with a difficult situation. If my duty or my role requires me to take it head on and deal with it, I may resort to this kind of escapism, saying that anyway Swami knows best, He will change everything. I think Swami knows best and He will take care of everything is an attitude and is the solution we resort to when I look at my, you know, at my own roster of duties expected from my role, whatever that role be, as a father, as an employee, as a brother, as a husband or whatever. If that doesn't lie in the purview of that, then I can say it is beyond me. What else can I do other than pray for it? You know, there are some horrendous or horrible acts happening along the country's borders. What can I do? Possibly just pray for it. But if I happen to be a soldier on the border, I can't say I will throw away my gun, I will throw away my arms, and you know, Swami is omnipresent, omnipotent, He'll take care. No, if I am a soldier, I need to be vigilant, I need to give up my sleep, be alert, and do my duty. But if I am not a soldier, say I am sitting in a city and I am working on something, I feel for that, maybe I can pray. And I think this kind of separation, we need to have it clear in our head. Because many times, we become like the soldier who doesn't do the duty simply because it is pleasant and easier to sit back and rest and assuage the guilt that is coming within me with the thought that anyway Swami knows best, He will take care. No. Within my purview, within the responsibilities and roles assigned to me, if it lies, I have to speak up. I think that is the reason why in the Kaurava court, Krishna says that to Bhishma, when I was seeing a version of the Mahabharata being presented on television, Krishna tells Bhishma that each of those arrows are for the times you have just kept quiet, silent, you know. When injustice is happening, wrong things are happening, you are supposed to speak up, you have not spoken up. You have, in your presence it has happened. So for each of those, there is one arrow that has penetrated his body and he is lying there. He had to lie in that pain and misery for so many days. But that same crime or mistake is not attributed to, say, a soldier who is standing or a courtier in the Kaurava court. Possibly because the courtier is not expected to do any of that. The soldier is not expected to take action on that. But as a king's advisor, you are supposed to. So I think this is a very dynamic kind of proposition. If you look at that way, we cannot say that every time you have to do something or every time you have to just sit quiet and allow it to pass. It totally depends on what are our roles and responsibilities, and I think that's where understanding our duties becomes so important.
Absolutely. And the reason why even if you look at texts like Bhagavad Gita, it's actually precisely about choice making, right? About how do you choose what is the action that you need to do. Because, you know, that's the quintessential question that Arjuna asks him. You know, am I supposed to fight, or am I supposed to give way? Am I supposed to forgive, or am I supposed to act upon it?
Mm.
So it's the question and everything. I think any scripture which talks about this choice making always makes a reference to having absolute control over one's emotions. Because as long as that is not achieved, you will never be practical and, you know, without letting that cloud your decision making. You will never be subjective in making a decision. Objective in making a decision as long as you have had that control over your senses. And I think that is one of the reasons why it is spoken of as, because it's a dynamic, as you're saying, it's a dynamic proposition. It is not fixed. You cannot have one size fits all approach to that. And that is why you kind of clear your mind and you're able to see what is that that needs to be done. The other point that occurs to me when Swami is saying this, you know, there is misunderstanding with regards to omnipresence of God, and there's something that needs to be done. I think Swami uses these two phrases extensively in some of his Vahinis, especially in Prema Vahini. Swami speaks about Vidya Maya and Avidya Maya. Right? Maya itself is avidya. It's supposed to be ignorance. Right? But Swami says there are two types of Maya, Vidya Maya and Avidya Maya. And when Swami speaks about worldly people and spiritual people, Swami says worldly people are lost in Avidya Maya, but spiritual people give themselves up to Vidya Maya.
Right? Okay.
So Avidya Maya is you first of all don't think of God, you're only fixated about the world and the benefits of the world. You're going after a mirage, after a shadow, right? But Swami says Vidya Maya is you understand that this is not reality, but still you hold on to a little bit of Maya so that you're able to go beyond this. So even when you think Swami is God, I am a devotee, I have to worship Swami, or you know this is right and that is wrong, because there is no distinction actually. But you hold on to a little bit of Maya so that you can transcend this Maya. Swami says that is Vidya Maya. So even though when you say that everything is done by Swami, Swami knows everything, that is not in our experience right now. So you hold on to a little bit of Maya to say that this is what I need to do. I as an individual have to do this. I as a person, this is my duty. You hold on to a little bit of Maya so that you can overcome this Maya. That becomes Vidya Maya. And Swami says a spiritual aspirant should essentially occupy himself or herself with that kind of Maya.
I think to make Vidya Maya and Avidya Maya clear, we can again use the analogy of the drama. Avidya Maya possibly is when I don't know that I'm actually acting a script that's in the drama and I'm affected deeply by the storyline of the drama. Something happens, I'm sad, and if something happens, I'm so happy, or there's a tragedy, there's a comedy. But Vidya Maya is like being a good actor, wherein you act your role so well, nobody can point a finger. In fact, when you go through pain, anybody who is watching the drama goes through that pain. They shed tears for your character. But within your own heart, you are actually not at all happy. I mean, not at all sad. Neither are you elated. You are in a state of perfect equilibrium. You are just acting out your role perfectly. And to act out that role perfectly, you need some amount of costume, you need some amount of, you know, relationship with the other characters on the stage. And I think that is possibly Vidya Maya, because Swami would often say that I came in this human form so that you can associate with me. And at the same time, I show you glimpses of my divinity so that you don't forget what my identity is. I mean, I'm just paraphrasing. These are not his exact words. But when Swami says that, I feel him showing his divinity is in order to destroy that Avidya Maya. And him behaving like one among us is to foster that Vidya Maya in us so that we use, I think a positive use of Maya is Vidya Maya. Right. And a destructive and delusional use of Maya is the Avidya Maya.
Right. So that is the first thing that Swami says. In fact, the answer that Swami gave Hislop is not complete as yet. Mm-hmm. Because Swami continues. Probably I'll read that statement again which Swami gave in reply. Swami says, there is much nonsense about Swami being omnipresent and omnipotent. People start to think that they need to do nothing, that Swami will do everything. Then they do not bother to even do their duty, daily duty. Then Swami goes on to say, in spiritual life, the relationship between you and Swami is heart to heart. But in worldly life, Swami has given you work to do. This requires work in the world, activity in the world. You are required to do your duty to the very limit of the task. So far as writing is concerned, the writing of letters to Swami is for your own satisfaction. So that is what Swami says, whatever we were discussing about Swami telling about duty, that a task has been given. And interestingly, you know, when you have the opportunity to live with an avatar, observe an avatar, these are not merely words. We have seen it. One of the classic things I always quote is, Swami has come out for darshan, right? And Swami would go around giving darshan, and Swami would go inside the interview room. You will find the whole portico being emptied after that. Can you imagine that? Just a door away, you have God. But here are people getting up and going away. That's because that is the system Swami had set. That after darshan, all the doctors and teachers who were sitting in that portico had to vacate and go for their work. There is no way that any of them can be seated there. Because if Swami finds you sitting there when you have some other work, you'll get a piece of his mind, right? Because that is the setup Swami had said, that even if God is there right in front of you, if you've been assigned a duty, that should take precedence over that, right? It's a demonstration of what Swami said. I mean, you cannot sit there saying that anyway Swami is the doer of doing everything. You have to honor that duty that Swami himself has given you, knowing very well that it is the same Swami who's operating through you.
Absolutely. In fact, after that Swami says...
Hislop asks...
When Swami says that writing letters to Swami is for your satisfaction, Hislop asks, for my satisfaction, Swami? Yes, for your satisfaction. You write to Swami and your mind is then free of the matter. It is not that Swami does not know. Suppose you withhold some troublesome point, you then have a guilty feeling. But you tell Swami and there is no guilty feeling. Do your duty fully and completely in the work which Swami has given to you. And there are any number of experiences which go to show this aspect that we write letters to Swami for our own satisfaction, our own benefit, our own easing of the mind, rather than for informing Swami. The most popular one that I have heard about is one that concerns Dr. M. Sainath, who was a physics lecturer in our university. He had the privilege of helping Swami, assisting Swami in his own room, and therefore he has had many intimate experiences. At close quarters, he has got the opportunity to observe Swami. So he says how one evening, a few others along with himself got into this discussion as to how it would be physically impossible for Swami to read every letter that he picks. Because on an average day, Swami must be picking at least 500 to 1000 letters, and it's humanly impossible to read it. So this was going on, and Sainath sir was of the opinion that definitely Swami will not be reading all the letters. He'll be just taking it. And sure enough, the next day or so, he was in the interview room along with Swami, and he saw Swami picking up letters and kind of sorting them, glancing at them, and many of the letters were going straight into the dustbin. And in his mind he thought, I think Swami is showing this to me because this message has to be conveyed. I will go back and report to all others that I was right. Physically, Swami doesn't have time to read all these letters. And even as he was thinking that, Swami called him and asked, what are you thinking? What? I mean, I'm sorry, Swami didn't ask the whole sentence, what are you thinking? Swami just looked at him and asked, what? He said, nothing, Swami. Tell me what? He said, no, nothing, Swami. And Swami called him close. And Swami said, now tell me what? He said, Swami, actually, one thing was running in my head. Then immediately Swami cut him there and said, then why you didn't say so? Don't ever hide anything from your guru. And that was an important lesson in itself. Then he said, Swami, why is it that you're not reading them, you're just throwing them with so much of effort the devotee would have written. Swami then told him, you pick any letters now. Pick any letter from this. He picked it up. Swami told him, go back to where you were standing. Now open it and read it. He said, no, Swami, this is addressed to you and I don't want to. Swami said, no, you open it. And when he opened it, Swami started saying, it's that Mukherjee or Banerjee, I forget, but a Bengali Mukherjee or Banerjee. Swami said, it's that Mukherjee, right, from Bengal, and from Calcutta. And his son had taken ill, and he was very worried, and he had come, and Swami had given vibhuti. Now it's all fine. He has returned to express his gratitude to Swami, correct? And I'm just giving again a summary here, but Swami gave all the details exactly it had been written in that letter, and this was a random letter that he had picked up from the pile. And, you know, it had been unopened. And at that time, you know, Sainath sir fell on his knees, went back to Swami and said, Swami, when this is the case, then why do we even write letters? And that is when Swami told him that you are writing letters not for Swami to know. Swami knows everything. But when you write a letter, you find joy, you find relief. And that is also a point in time when you get the unity of your thought, word and deed. You are thinking something. You're putting it into words and you're also acting upon it, because writing is an action. So this is a beautiful moment where your thought, word and deed comes together, and whenever thoughts, words and deeds come together, that thing gets achieved, whether it's negative or positive. So why not make it come together for a positive manner? And therefore, you know, Swami encouraged, saying that you should write letters. But know that it is for your satisfaction, for your benefit, not for Swami. I think when we know this basic, then we won't be disappointed if Swami doesn't take our letter. Because the purpose of the letter is already served the moment I write it. Because it was for my own sake that I wrote it. If Swami takes it, that's a bonus. But even if he doesn't take it, it's no problem because Swami has no need for the letter. And I think that is the same message Swami amplifies here.
Right. As you were saying, any number of such examples of Swami knowing very well what is going into a letter, even before it went in, and even when you're writing it, one famous episode, I don't recall whose it is to be told when we were students, of someone who really wanted to know whether Swami knows what is written in a letter and why this act of writing something, and he tried giving an empty piece of paper to Swami to see whether Swami will pick that letter. Mm. If he picks a letter, then it means that he doesn't know that it's an empty paper. If Swami avoids it, then probably he has a hint of what is there. But Swami goes up to the person and takes the letter, and then Swami tells him, if only your mind was as clean as this piece of paper that you're giving me, Swami tells him and walks away. There is one episode, the other is one student was narrating how when they were standing for darshan, those were the days when they used to stand in front of Trai Vrindavan. They would not sit in the Ramesh hall. So when they were standing there, I think he and another boy had a small scuffle waiting, you know, who would get that place in front or something. And Swami noticed it. And Swami comes up to him and Swami asks, what happened? And they said, no, Swami, nothing at all. And then later he started feeling guilty that, you know, he shouldn't have lied to Swami when Swami was asking him. So he wants to write a letter to Swami saying that he was very sorry. I behaved in that manner and I said a lie when you came and asked me. And he chooses to write a letter 11 in the night. And he finds that everybody is asleep and he doesn't have a decent piece of paper on which he can write and an envelope to go with it. And he finds that the boy with whom he had a fight was the only person who was awake. Right. Mm. So he goes and asks him and he gives him an envelope and a letter and he writes it. The next morning, this boy is standing with a letter to give it to Swami. And Swami comes up to him and Swami said, hey Mira, you went and took the letter from the same fellow you fought with. And then Swami said, what 11 o'clock you're sitting and writing sorry, sorry, sorry so many times. And Swami told him exactly the number of sorries is written in that letter.
Mm.
And then Swami said, okay, kid, just behave yourself. And then Swami went on to say that, you know, it is very common to have jealousy when you see somebody else getting an opportunity to Swami, but you should sublimate that emotion. Then Swami gave him that advice. So that thing is, it's a very, being with Swami, we know that for sure. He doesn't really need a letter. And still we continue to write a letter. And purely because of that satisfaction it gave.
I think definitely that is the case because I must confess that even to this day I write letters and place it in the altar. Because if it was truly about Swami physically reading it, what sense does it make for me to write and keep it now? I had my own little personal experience, you know. I had this liking to keep writing letters for the joy that I derive, you know, when Swami takes the letter from my hand.
Mm.
And I remember on one occasion, that is precisely what I had written in the letter, saying that, Swami, there's no other reason for me to write. Everything is going on fine, but I get joy when you receive this letter from me, so therefore I'm writing this letter. On that occasion in Sai Ramesh Hall, it was Vrindavan. Swami was scheduled to go out somewhere, so the car was also ready, and Swami told, I will just give a darshan and come back. I don't know if it was Swami's visit to Alike. He had to go to the airfield and by helicopter. Was it 2001 or something?
Right.
I don't know if it was exactly that, but I vividly remember Swami coming for darshan and the car waiting there already near the Kalyan Mandapam. And as Swami was walking, he came past by me but didn't take my letter. And I was like, oh, Swami didn't take the letter. But just before he could complete the darshan round and go on the stage, from the gent side area of the hall, he saw, I was seated along the center path, he saw me, came walking straight to me, stretched out his hand and said, give me. He took the letter, and that was the only letter in his hand at that point in time, because all others he had given it to the person walking behind. Swami went, sat on the stage, the letter was in his hand. He sat for just that bhajan which had to complete and then asked for aarti and walked into the car with the letter in hand. And I felt so happy, and then I thought, oh my God, this is exactly what I had prayed. I had prayed that, Swami, I want to give you the letter for the joy I get when I give you the letter. And how beautifully Swami had multiplied the joy. Again, it was for my sake. A kind of a negative example I remember of the same is, see, when you are in a happy state, like how I was during this episode, you write also happily. So I had written, Swami, I am writing this letter because of the joy I get when I give you. On another occasion when I was feeling very neglected, and you write, like you said, you know, you look at others getting chances and you feel, oh God, why am I not getting? So I wrote a letter saying, Swami, actually I have nothing to write in the letter, similar kind. But the reason I wrote there was, Swami, but I feel that by giving letters to you regularly, I can be in the top of your mind awareness. You know, so that, Arvind is there, you know. To remind you like that, for that sake I am writing, you know, that's what I had written. I remember this was inside Trai Brindavan, and I was seated some fourth or fifth line from the jhula. As Swami came walking in, some of us stretched out the letters and Swami took, he took my letter as well. And as he sat on the jhula, he told somebody to speak. And he was casually glancing at the letters, which was a rare thing those days. He would never read. But he just looked, glanced. And interestingly, I could make out from my handwriting, he picked up my letter, just opened it, not even for a second, closed it back. And right in front of him, you know, at that other point, I think either the speaker had not yet started speaking or he had just concluded. So there was absolute silence. And he tore it to shreds. Rip, rip, rip. That sound was heard. You know, it reverberated throughout this thing. And he just smiled. Not even at me, he just smiled. And he threw the pieces of paper down. And that's it. Nobody knew whose letter it was. I got the message. I think in both the incidents, one in a kind of a happy manner, one in a kind of a hitting manner, both ways it was clearly reinforced that letters are for your sake. Swami doesn't need, Swami knows everything. But when you write a letter, you get an experience, you get either a hit or a high. So letter writing is purely for yourself, and I would highly recommend, even this day, write letters to Swami regularly, if not daily.
In fact, you know, it has now become one of the tools in psychology to deal with negativity. Many times, even when you're writing a letter to Swami, you're writing a problem. I think without our knowledge, we will put in a line saying that, Swami, I know that you're in charge. Invariably, it happens. When you're placing a problem in front of Swami, even as you're writing it, you yourself will know that anyway, Swami, you know everything and you're in control. We would commit that in words in some form when we're writing a letter.
And reinforces,
it reinforces us. In fact, the whole thing comes from a very famous episode from Abraham Lincoln's life. In fact, he was very famous for unposted letters. Right? Because it was a technique that he had used in his form of leadership. I don't know exactly the details. One of the anecdotes from his life is about a general who was fighting in the Civil War, to whom he had given an instruction which he did not follow, and because of which they lost an advantage in the Civil War. And the Civil War had to extend for many weeks or months thereafter. So Lincoln was very, very upset about that, you know, that insubordination by the general. So he writes a very bitter letter. I recall reading that letter. In our terms, you would never call that bitter. It was in such soft language. And in those times, it was supposed to be a very firm and bitter letter where he says, you've disappointed me and you've led me to immense distress because of your actions and all that. The general never got to read that letter because it was never posted. Right? So he'd written that letter and he had put it in his desk. Apparently, he would do that as a means of emptying himself of the negativity. You know, because he would say that had I sent that letter to the general, it would have demotivated him and he would have tried to justify what he had done, right? And in the process, if there were any flaws in his decision, he would have overlooked it. Instead, if I just supported him, saying that, okay, I don't know what prompted you to take that decision in the ground, what had led you to do that, but I stand by you, I stand by your decision, then the person who has done the mistake, he would self-introspect and say that, okay, these are things I should have avoided. But on the other hand, if you accuse that person will, you know,
get
try
defensive.
To defensive and he will kind of reaffirm whatever he has done. So this was a technique that he had used as leadership, and apparently that same general was instrumental in much greater victories and smaller battles later because of the confidence that it you know, imposed on him. And this is a technique which Abraham Lincoln would tell all his people, that if you have anything bitter to tell about somebody, write it down in a paper. and then tear it up. So now you're done with that negativity. And that's, I think, as a tool in psychology, it is used. And when Swami says here, we've seen that, you know, on one hand, we know Swami knows what goes into a letter. On the other hand, we know that when we write a letter and give it to him, it gives us a sense of unburdening our problems. Okay, now I've given it up to Swami. And I think just yesterday I was listening for our listeners who probably are not aware, one of the Sai centers, I think the Atlanta Sai Center, they are doing a beautiful compilation of
devotees' experiences.
They had, I think, wanted to do 95, but the last video that I saw was already 100. So I think they're continuing with that. It's a wonderful YouTube channel, right? It's a YouTube channel, Atlanta Sai Center. I don't know what it's called, but 95 stories. That's how they had started the playlist, but there are more there now.
They can maybe aim for 950 now.
Yeah, I think it's going to be endless. So very sweet, small episodes. And one of those that I heard was about one of the devotees when she was getting married. She was getting married to a person whom her father didn't approve of. And then they go and they give a letter to Swami. And Swami accepts it. And she comes and says, Swami has accepted a letter, which means Swami has approved of it. Mm. So I said, no, Swami accepts so many letters, you cannot take that. I think Swami gives her a vibhuti. Right, the first one is Swami giving her vibhuti, and Swami says, no, that cannot be taken as approval. The second time again, second day again, Swami comes and gives her vibhuti. And then the father says, you know, you are so looking so tired because of the jet lag. So Swami, out of compassion, would have come and given you vibhuti again. So the third day, when he writes a letter saying that, Swami, this is what my daughter is, she wants to marry this person. I don't want this, and I don't approve of this. Please somehow help me installing the wedding. Mm. And Swami avoids him completely, you know, even though he is sitting the first row. Mm. On the other hand, he goes and picks up the letter of his daughter and his wife who have written saying that, Swami, we want your blessings. Right? So we know that, I mean, letters, Swami and devotees is a Bhagavatam of its own. Right? Mm. But we have all experienced that unburdening, that self-satisfaction that comes, and that reinforcement which comes by the simple act of writing letters to Swami.
In fact, so much speaking about writing letters, I think that is the impact of satsang. I'm inspired to write a letter today, and I resolve that today, tonight before I go to bed, I'm going to write a letter to Swami. And I think that would be a nice resolution, dear listeners. We will take a little break now. During the break, probably as you listen to the beautiful music, you can mull over what you would like to write to Swami. Write it to Swami. I think it's a good practice. If we can make it a daily practice, end of the day, superb, nothing like it. But at least regularly, let us write letters to Swami, place it at our own altar. And yeah, after that, dispose it as we want, because these letters will definitely bring healing, calm, peace and joy in our own hearts. See you after this little break. Don't go away anywhere.
To you, Lord, I To you, Lord Sun, we give our hands. To you, Lord Sun, we give our all. To you, Lord Sun, we give our all. To you, Lord Sun, we give our all. To you, Lord Sun.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We'll go back into this conversation. The previous question that we addressed was Heslop asking about writing letters and in general the idea of thinking that Swami is omnipresent and omnipotent. Is there anything that we need to do? Swami says that's a mistake. You have to first find out what is it that you need to do in the capacity of whatever role that you're playing. And that should not be mixed with this idea that Swami knows everything and Swami doesn't need our input in the form of actions. The next question that Hislop asks is also in a way connected to this discussion. Hislop asks, Swami, I have two questions important for our work in daily life and in preparation for the symposium in Rome. So this is 1983, I think, because the symposium in Rome happened in the October of 1983. So this might be in 83 or 82. One of the symposiums, I think, for which Swami even sent a couple of students from here to represent. Swami wrote a very beautiful message. I think that can itself be a subject for a satsang. Unity is divinity or something is the topic on which Swami had written. A very beautiful message for that convention.
I think last year, based on this theme or something, last year or the year before last, international organization released
a... The document was based on unity is divinity.
And purity is something.
Something. That was the phrase on which Swami had written.
Mm.
So he's asking in connection with that also. So he says, and in preparation for the symposium in Rome, In his discourses, Swami says that God should be recognized as the doer of all actions and that we should not take it upon ourselves to be the doer. Further, Swami also says that instead of depending on limited human strength, we should call upon the strength of God. Since Swami says these two things in discourses, then the instructions must be intended for everybody. Swami replies, take the viewpoint that God is working through you. Hislop asks, what does that mean, Swami? How does that apply in the actual actions taking place each day? Swami says, you think you are engaging in the action, but it is your body doing so, or your mind, or your intelligence. But God is working through them. It is only the Atma in you which is the source of action. That Atma is God.
I think when we are able to do this, you know, when Swami says engage in action, knowing fully well that you are just an instrument, your body and mind is an instrument to carry out the will of God. Atma is the doer. I think that is what actually results in us doing seva, in us being selfless. And it's a little bit confusing because you wonder, what does it mean? How do I start doing it? I also don't know how do we exactly begin. It's a journey that each one has to discover. But possibly we can look at, again, the why of what we are doing. When the why is selfless, I think then we are truly treating the body and mind as instruments through which God can work through. When there is love, when there is selflessness, and that results in joy, positivity. I was just reading an experience of an alumna from the Anandpur College.
Mm-hmm.
Recently there was a book that was released by the 1981 batch of students. Anandpur College pass outs, and they're all in different countries, in different spheres of life. Some are homemakers, some are active professionals, some are in very high positions, some are in humble positions, but all of them united by this common thread of love for Swami. It's a beautiful collection of experiences and incidents. One of that is an alumna who is even now serving as one of the security girls, security aunties, if I can say, but they call themselves security girls because they are the daughters of Sai. And she writes of a day when Swami had called a group of people from the hospital for an interview, and one doctor whom she knows well, she happened to come late, and when she came late and she got to know that Swami had called them for an interview, she began to feel very bad. She felt that she had missed the interview, and she began to speak to this person saying that, look at this, I missed this darshan, I missed this chance, oh God, what do I do, why am I so unlucky? And as a security girl, you're not supposed to speak to anybody, it's a discipline. So she didn't respond anything, but inwardly she felt her pain, you know. She said that I could feel how much bad she was feeling if all the security girls had been called in and I was not called in, how I would have been feeling. Because it's not as if Swami calls in for an interview daily, it's a rare occasion and she has missed it. And in her heart she kept crying to Swami, saying, Swami, this is very unfair, you know. And plus, she knew this person personally, so she said, she's such a good person, Swami, she does so much, and now at least you know that she's here, go. And it was against the discipline that she couldn't walk in now, it was all silent, you know how it would be. Swami is conducting the interviews, whole hall is silent, the only people making noise, not only people, only beings making sounds are possibly the birds that are chirping and cooing there. Otherwise, it's absolutely silent, no walking, nothing. So when this was going on, the interview room door opened and out walks Swami. The interview is complete and so is her sorrow now. It's gone. She's now nothing she can do. But Swami comes walking straight towards where these two are seated, the security girl as well as this doctor. And Swami comes and says, why are you so sad? Swami asks her directly. And she says, Swami, because I missed the interview. Swami said, why did you miss the interview? She said, Swami, I was in hospital. Why, your hospital goes on so late, is it? Does it not get over by now? She said, yes, Swami, but there were people and I wanted to do, so I continued to work. And then Swami, you know, made his eyes big in wonderment, and Swami said, oh, you are doing seva. And then he beamed a big smile. He became so happy. And Swami said, come here. And Swami there and then materialized a beautiful ring, gave it to her, blessed her, gave her padnamskar, and said, Swami said, I am very, very happy. Continue to do your duty. And you know, it was like two birds in one act, because this security girl was feeling so happy that, you know, I cried out, you know, one selfless prayer and Swami is instantly responding. And even here, it is not as if you missed anything, you had to give up anything because you were doing your duty or you were doing seva. So again, this whole incident reinforces everything that we have been speaking about today. Do your duty, do it sincerely, do it with selflessness. God knows everything. He doesn't need any special recommendation. He will respond at a perfect moment and in the most beautiful manner possible.
Right. And this question probably is is something that cannot be explained in a very simple way. And you can see that also. Because when you say that everything is Swami is the doer of everything, statements like not even a strand of grass moves without his will. The immediate question that comes, and we will see that even Hislop asking, what about evil? What about wrong? What about bad actions? Hmm. Are they also done by God? Right? And this is always a question that will come. And Swami has explained this. The reason why it cannot be explained very simply is there are different ways of looking at it. You know, when you say doer of actions, there are two ways of looking at it. Is it the one who is choosing to do something, or is it somebody who is the source of all energy that is making anything happen? Right? When you, Swami would give the example of electricity. Swami would say that the same electricity brightens a place, the lights under which a surgeon saves somebody's life, is the same electricity which is used in an electric chair to execute somebody. But can you say that the electricity is saving life? Electricity is taking life. The electricity is just being itself, right? And the example which is often given in some of the Upanishads is, there is fire. You go and put your hand in the fire. It burns you, right? You say the fire burnt me. But can you attach intention to fire? The fire did not come and burn you. The fire was burning. You put your hand in the fire. The fire burnt you, right? The fire, you cannot attach any will in that sense to fire. The fire was just being itself. So when we often say that God is the doer of all actions and everything, God exists as sentience in all beings and that expresses itself as actions, but you cannot attach any motive or any good or bad or right or wrong to God. So in that sense, God is the doer, because often in many of the scriptures you will find this. You say that you're not the doer. But then you also say that the Atma never kills, the Atma never does, the Atma never does this or does that. Then who is the doer? But you find all the time actions happening. So when you say God is the doer, you cannot attribute choice to him. Mm. But at the same time, this is a understanding that comes as a maturity of thought. We often think that either this or that. That doesn't work in spirituality. You kind of mature to that thought to understand that nothing happens without God's will. And the best way that thought expresses in our life is through humility. Right? You undergo, you do whatever you're supposed to do. You're a student. At the end of it, you get a good grade. You say that it was because of Swami's grace. It expresses as humility. It might appear like, but I was the one who studied. I was the one who sat late and studied. But you could not have done it without God's grace, right? You could have the best air conditioner, but without power, it's nothing. It's just a piece of junk, right? And that is the same idea that needs to be internalized. And that is where the same concept of Vidyamaya and Avidyamaya comes. Sometimes when you act, you have to forget that and you have to act as though everything depends on your action. But then after that, you believe that it could not have happened without God's grace at all.
That is indeed Vidyamaya, and we'll just read through the same thing that happens as a discussion between Hislop and Swami. Hislop says, then instead of considering that it is myself acting, I should tell myself and appreciate that I is just a word and that all these actions and movements going on are not coming from Hislop, but are actually God himself acting. And Swami says, God is using your intelligence, mind and body as his instruments for doing the particular work. You write with a pen or cut paper with scissors, but it is not those instruments that are doing the work. It is you who are using the instruments with a purpose of doing the work. Likewise, the instruments you call yourself, which is your intelligence, your mind and your body, they are used by God for His purpose. Hislop then asks, is that a practical thing to do, Swami, hour in and hour out? Tell myself that my body and my mind, at any and every moment, they are at that moment being used by God as His instrument? Is that a practical way to live and move through the day? Yes, that is the fact, and it is also practical. And then Hislop raises the point, but Swami, then it is God doing evil. And Swami says, at first, apparently yes, but then not. It is not God who does evil. Evil is from the ego. So, every time what we think of as evil, you know, evil comes because of ego or me identifying myself with my body and mind and not with God. Now, I was just thinking, maybe it's not a very apt example, but I just remember when we were in the AVC department in Vrindavan, we were supposed to handle all the mics, the sound systems and everything. And we wanted to install a new speaker inside Thrai Vrindavan.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just one speaker hanging from a wall. It will not disturb anybody. And yet, so many permissions to be taken, so many things to be done, so many things we had to get in place. And finally, even when Swami permitted, we would get inside Thrai Vrindavan and work when Swami was out for darshan, fixing it. And then, first put the stand which is going to hold the speaker, and then insert the speaker, and then cover the speaker with a cloth. And each day it was done in stages. And each day we would be made to sit and observe Swami, how he is looking, whether he is responding well or not. And finally Swami let it be, but it took us 4 days, which would have otherwise taken us something like half an hour to do it. If there was a speaker to be installed in the hostel, we would have just done it. Why did this difference come when I think of it? I'm thinking it's because the hostel, I feel it's mine. Ours it is. We'll do whatever and we did it. But that is Swami's. We have to see. Just hope that he's not upset. Do it stage by stage. Is it fine? At every point, we are checking back whether Swami is fine with it. Did he frown at the stand? Did he frown at the speaker? I think that is how we will behave when we are convinced that something belongs to Swami. If I truly belong, that my body belongs to Swami, there will be no impulsive going and slapping somebody because he irritated me. If I truly believe that my speech belongs to Swami, I might possibly not abuse somebody. I feel that it belongs to me, me meaning my mind and my body. And that's why possibly I abuse somebody, I talk behind their back, or I hit somebody, or even think of, oh, I wish I can murder this fellow. I wish I can, either way, negative or positive also. I want to reward this person. This person is great. Either way, I think all that comes from me believing that I am the body and mind. So what Swami says here is the truth, and it might be a little difficult for us to understand, but when I'm truly living with the spirit that it's just an instrument, it belongs to Swami, there'll be a lot more thought, lot more maturity before I put my body or mind or my speech to any use.
One way of probably looking at it is, again, there is no way in which it can be completely explained. It's something that needs to evolve in the mind and understanding. Imagine that you are a son of a rich man,
mm-hmm.
right? And your father holds enormous amount of property and enormous amount of wealth. But he leads a very simple life, and you probably don't know that, that's your inheritance, right? But the father is thinking that I will look at my son or my daughter and see, observe his activities. And if I'm satisfied at one point that he or she deserves this wealth, then I will inform him that this is what you own, right? But all through that money belongs to you, right? Because it's your father's money and it's going to come to you. And let's say that there is no way it's not going to come to you. So it is the fact that you are rich, but you don't know it till a point in time. So you have to lead your life in a certain manner to understand or gain that knowledge that you're rich.
Mm,
I think nice. That is precisely what we are going through. When you're acting, right, in this stage of ignorance, you have to constantly choose that this is right, this is wrong, this is what I need to do. Till a point comes when you will find that it was the same, I was always rich. It was not that when I was doing the wrong thing, I was any less richer, or when I was making wrong choices, I was any less that made me a poor person. But to understand that, you need to graduate to the point where you're given that knowledge. So,
and you take it from the Father's perspective, that is God's perspective. One might say, till now you have not given that soul so far because you want to see whether he or she is worthy of handling it.
Right.
What if after you give it, they may handle? You know, because somebody once asked, Swami says we have to consider ourselves as God. If I believe that I am God, can I go and murder someone? Can I go and steal? I think once the Father knows that this has got into the DNA or got into the bones of that son, knows how to manage the money, and yes, he may make mistakes, but he knows that this is wrong, this is right, and there's no way he's going to willfully squander away the wealth. Once it is given, the maturity remains. Because I remember when this question was asked to Swami, Swami, if I consider myself as God, is that not a kind of ego? Swami said, no, that's not ego, but you just tell yourself and God and do whatever nonsense you do, then it is not. When you're God, automatically, you know, if you genuinely are believing in that, automatically that maturity is there where you act in a proper manner. So too, I think once that point is crossed, that is when possibly your sadhana is not required. But till then, that sadhana is needed, because in the process of sadhana itself, that maturity and everything comes in.
Right. And that is why this is a truth. Right? You know, whether you experience it right now or not, the truth is he alone is the doer. Whatever is being done, whatever you speak, whether it is sweet words, harsh words, it cannot be possible without, you know, whether your instrument is working well or not. For both, you need the same power, right? It could be a faulty instrument. It might have a speaker which has gone bad. But even, right, but even for that, it needs the same power. But you are now, what we are trying to do is, you know, the truth is being tried to use now. When I use that truth that Swami alone is the doer, whatever I achieve, it is because of Swami, that brings in the idea of humility, and it kind of brings down that concept of doership, right? And that will automatically, it has its own repercussions. You know, you're not attached to the actions, you're not attached to the results. There's a fair amount of detachment which comes in. So all of that comes in when you are able to bring in this truth from the future. At some point, I'm going to have this full understanding that I'm not this body, I'm not this mind, I'm not the doer. But that information, just like same thing, you know, your father might tell you that you're too young to inherit the property. But the idea that I'm going to inherit the property will make me a little more free at this moment, and it'll give me a little more peace of mind in the present, right? So that is what we're trying to do in spirituality. And that's why this question will always come, what about evil? What about those who do evil? Maybe even that is important in the present, that even the evil that is happening, maybe it is happening for a purpose, and that can give a certain sense of balance in our thinking. It is not to, again, as you said, as a convenient way of looking past evil or being silent when something wrong is happening. There again, it comes down to intent and you know, what is driving your silence, what is driving your actions.
I think on that note, we will take another quick little break, dear listeners, and on the other side of the break, continue with this discussion.
Raghunandana hai Raghunandana
Raghunandana, Raghunandana,
Welcome back, dear listeners. We will continue the conversation between Hislop and Swami. As Swami says that at first it appears as if evil is also being done by God. Evil happens only when the ego takes over and it's no longer in God's charge. And Hislop has some doubt at this point. He just begins by saying, when I die, but at that point in time, Swami interrupts him and says, who are you? You do not die. The body is like clothes, off and on. Hislop continues, then after the body dies, I take another. Why? I think this question comes because Swami has said that God is the only doer. Then he's saying, why is it then after I die that after the body dies, why another body is taken? And Swami replies, the balance of desires. Desires are like seeds. They sprout. These desires cause rebirth. Finish with desires, no more birth. Mind is a desire bundle. So, it's almost like Swami is saying, don't mix this and that. The body just like whatever, you know, when you use a scissor to cut a paper, it cuts. So, there is a action, there is a result that's happening. So, that is what it is. There is a desire and that desire acts like a seed and that sprouts and therefore this is happening. In no way does it mean that you become the doer. It is like I take a scissors and throw it. And the scissor undergoes breakage. So at this point in time, the question that arises is then why do you do like this, Swami? Why do you use one instrument in an evil way, one instrument in a good way? I think when we reach a level of me not considering myself, my body as myself, but as an instrument, then how does it matter? How does it matter whether the scissors is thrown or whether the scissors is used? How does it matter whether the knife is placed on a pedestal or whether it's thrown in the dirt? It should not matter at all because I am not the knife. So I think in part it is also because of our own confusion where I think we move from Dvaita to Vishishta Dvaita to Advaita and then back and it becomes a full jumble in the head. That's what at least happens to me and therefore I don't try to clearly resolve all these but choose the path that this is what a Swami is saying and we'll accept it. It's much more peaceful, it's much more comfortable and go ahead and if at all there are frustrations and irritations on the way, there is a letter writing that I can do.
Absolutely. As they say, these are discussions that can go on till the cows come home, as the expression goes, because it's very difficult to resolve, right? Swami, what he says here about desires, this is something that Swami often tells us. The best example, the analogy that Swami would give is about rice and husk. Swami would say, you remove the husk, the grain cannot be used to further plant paddy. But the same thing with the husk, you'll get the next generation of paddy and then again the next generation. Some would say that husk is the desire. You remove that and with that the rebirth also goes. And it's all in that idea of, you know, even when Swami is telling you consider yourself as an instrument, the whole root cause of everything Swami says is that ahankara, right? When you say this aham is attached to an akara, a form, when I think I am this body, when I think I am this personality, you come and tell me anything against me, I get angry about it. And when I get angry, I want to act on it. And when I want to act on it, it kind of spirals into another set of do's and actions and reactions to that. It goes on and on. But the moment I, as that conversation you were referring to, when I think I am God, will I do anything wrong? Will I do anything? When you say aham, when you say, I am God, it is Aham Brahmasmi or whatever it is.
I am,
as Swami would say, Nenu Nene. Then you are actually associating yourself with a limitless being. I don't lack anything. There's nothing like you are telling me something, I'm going to be upset about it. Or there is no craving. When I am everything, what should I seek? What should I gain? There's nothing for me to acquire. There's nothing for me to become richer by acquiring. So with that idea that I am this body, everything that is associated with evil or jealousy or anger or greed, or everything goes away with that, right? Because we are not able to envision that idea, what will happen if I believe that I am God? All these questions arise, right? And one of the things that is easier to for us to comprehend is desire, because desire is something that we work with every day, day in and day out. That's why Swami is saying the desire goes, then there is no question of being born again.
There's a term that Swami would use in his discourses called expansion love.
Right.
See, sometimes it so happens that we derive the benefits of this expansion love. I might not be identifying myself with this body, but with something that is larger. Possibly, you know, I identify myself with the Sai movement. So if somebody comes and criticizes me and says, Arvind, you're a stupid idiot, I have no problem with that. But if somebody criticizes Swami or the Sai movement, I get up in arms. So as you said, ahamkara is that aham is attached to an akara. And though the akara is not my body and my mind, it is definitely an akara, because which is associated with possibly the organization or the trust or even larger, which is Swami's name and form. But even then, it is a name and form. Though Swami's name and form is much, much more broader, expansive than anything else, it is still a name and form. And as long as I have got my identity attached to that, there is bound to be a separation, you know, me and not me kind of.
Right.
Unless that grows into the Vishwa Virata Swarupa, as Swami would call it, when I'm associating it with the whole universe, then there is no other. There is no other. There is no me and the other. So I think Swami would tell us to inculcate this expansion love, where we keep growing and growing till there is nothing like the other left. There is no other. In fact, that is also the practice that is done during the Jyoti meditation, where the light is expanded to the light from me, that light that emerges from within me is expanded to cover the entire visible and invisible universe, to reinforce the truth that it's all one, it's all one. I think that is the ultimate goal of expansion love, where we expand to a level where I'm identifying myself, the aham, with the akara that is, there's nothing else beyond that akara. That is the Vishwa Virata Swarupa of the Lord. And I think till we do that, there is bound to be all these kind of questions, and it's going to happen. Swami, in fact, after this, Hislop says, Swami, but this creation, the world, the body, the mind, is it a projection of the Atma? Are body, mind, intelligence creations or projections of the Atma? And Swami says, creation is from the Atma. The Atma, God, is positive, body is negative. They join and action results. Otherwise, nothing. Hislop again reiterates, there is the Atma, and then creation as the projection from the Atma. So I'm saying, no, that is where the mistake is made. Creation is not a projection of the Atma. The Atma, God, is permeating every fiber of the creation. The form is just appearance. It is energy, God, the divine energy which causes the form and which is the actuality of the form. I don't know, at this point, you know, I feel empathy towards Hislop as well as towards Swami, because technically I just feel, if I had to explain some concept to my pet dog that I love a lot, how much ever I love the dog, I cannot explain. And I feel this is a kind of condition, because this is something that cannot be explained. That is what it is said, it has to be experienced. Possibly Swami comes to some, Swami's explanation comes closest to the best that we can possibly get, but that's about it.
Right. And this idea again, you know, we've heard this statement also being made by Swami, that the entire creation is the projection of the mind. Right? It is not that what Hislop is asking is completely something external, or very weird to Swami's literature. But I think the message that Swami is driving is very important. There are two ways of looking at it. One is to look at the entire creation as a projection. That is one approach, where you say everything is Maya, and Maya is itself is something which is a word which is used in Sanskrit is mithya.
False.
Satya and mithya. Actually, satya and asatya it should be, but satya and mithya, because mithya is something which appears real but which is not real, like a mirage, right?
Mm.
So in that sense, it is often spoken of as a projection of the mind. But at the same time, when you say something is a projection of something else, you're talking of a distance. You're talking of something being separate. And again, Swami says, referring to some of the Upanishads, especially Purusha Suktam Swami would say, God creates the world and fills the world is one of the ways in which creation is explained in Vedanta. Mm. Right? So Swami says, you know, that image also is important. Because if you remove that image, then you look at the world as something that you need to be distant from. You look at it as something as not God, right? So instead, the other way of looking at it is look at everything as Sarvam Kaluvidam Brahma, as Swami would say. Everything that is seen is another form of God. Right?
One way I just intellectually resolved this for myself is to think of it as the clay being used to make different things.
Right.
The clay is being used to make the pot. The clay is being made to you is being used to make different sized pots which can hold capacities. One is a drum, one is a pot, one is a whatever. It's being used to make a table. It's being used to make a chair. So when we say that God permeates all, everything is clay. You know, everything is clay. If you take the child's modeling clay, whether an owl is made or whether a chair is made, whether anything is made, it's all clay. So it's divinity in everything. But you know, when I look at it and say, that's an owl, that's a chair, oh, that's a table, oh, that's an orange. When I'm saying that, I think that is where it comes to it being a projection of my mind. Because I am blind to the clay, you know, I am unconsciously or consciously choosing to be blind to it. Like when I watch a movie, I am blind to the screen that is behind and I am watching only the projection that's going on. And I am so lost in the projection that I don't see the screen at all. Here also, I mean, we can try it out so many times practically. Just make a clay doll and show it to somebody and ask, what is this? They will tell you, hey, that's a doll. No, that's not a doll, that's clay. Right, they know that, but it's gone. So I think Swami is saying that God permeates the universe like the way clay permeates everything. It's made up of God only. Everything is made up of God. But when we say that, when Swami says that the entire universe you see is nothing but a projection of your mind, that is shown when I look at different things and say, hey, that's an owl, that's an animal. So I think that is where both these things are true. And this analogy is what explains it.
Right, and definitely it is not something that we can resolve over a discussion like this. That is why it calls for sadhana, as they often say, the process of shravanam, mananam and adhidhyasanam. These are truths that need to be heard, contemplated upon repeatedly, and then it will slowly seep into our experience and we'll start enlightening our actions and choices that we make. So it's best left at that. But nevertheless, going through the text gives us the opportunity to discuss some of these answers that Swami has given. And the same answers, I'm absolutely sure of that, when we come back to it in different points in our life, we will draw better understandings and more mature learnings from it. So even as we conclude this week's episode, dear listeners, let us vow to go back to these conversations. In fact, to every word of Swami, as and when we are able to, because every time we look at Swami's word, it's like looking at a mirror. It is going to show us where we are rather than what it really conveys at that point in time. So with that, dear listeners, we humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. We'll leave you with a song. We'll meet you again next week for continuing this book, this discussion on this book, Conversations with Bhagwan Shri Sathya Sai Baba. Thank you, Jai Sai Ram.
Sainatham bhajare sada Sainatham bhajare sada Sainatham bhajare sada satya charitam satya sainatham bhajare sada satya charitam sarvesham satya sainatham bhajare sada satya charitam sarvesham satya Sainatham bhajare sada satya charitam sarvesham satya
సదా సాయినాథం భజరే.